That morning, back in the classroom, I was a most inattentive pupil elsewhere, and the teacher had ample time and opportunity to satisfy his joy in punishing at least one small boy. It all seemed very hard, the severity of the teachers. But then, I consoled myself, that is why I came, to learn. That is why I reincarnated, although then I did not remember what it was that I had to relearn. I firmly believe in reincarnation. In Tibet, when one reaches a certain advanced stage of evolution, one can choose to go on to another plane of existence, or return to Earth to learn something more, or to help others. It may be that a wise man had a certain mission in life, but died before he could complete his work. In that case, so we believe, he can return to complete his task, providing that the result will be of benefit to others. People could have their previous incarnations traced back. There had to be certain signs, and the cost and time would prohibit it. The signs, as I had, were termed living incarnations. Earnest of stern treatment when they were young, as I had been, but became objects of reverence when they became older. Ace, I was going to have special treatment to force feed my occult knowledge. Why, I did not know, then. A rain of blows on my shoulders brought me back to the reality of the classroom with a violent jerk. Imbecile. The mind demons penetrated your thick skull. And I could do. You are fortunate that it is now time to attend service. At remark, the enraged teacher gave me a final hearty blow, for good measure, and stalked out of the room. A boy next to me said, "Don't forget, it's our turn to work in the kitchens this afternoon. Hope we get a chance to fill our sampa bags." Kitchen work was hard. The regulars they used to treat us boys as slaves. No hour of rest for us after kitchen hour. Hours of hard labor, then straight to the classroom again. Sometimes we would be kept later in the kitchens, and so be late for class. Fuming teacher would be waiting for us, and would lay about him with his stick without giving us any opportunity of explaining the reason. Day of work in the kitchens was nearly my last. We trooped reluctantly along the stone-flagged corridors towards the kitchens. We were met by an angry monk. "Come on, you lazy, useless rascals," he shouted. 10 of you, get in there and stoke the fires." Down another flight of steps we went. The heat was overpowering. In front of us we saw a ruddy light, the light of roaring fires. Huge piles of yak dung lay about. This was fuel for the furnaces. "Get those iron scoops and stoke for your lives," the monk in charge yelled. Poor 7-year-old among the others of my class, among whom was none younger than 17. I could scarcely lift the scoop, and in straining to put the fuel in the fire I tipped it over the monk's feet. With a roar of rage he seized me by the throat, swung me round, and tripped flying backwards. Full pain shot through me, and there was the sickening smell of burning flesh. Then against the red-hot end of the bar protruding from the furnace, with a scream to the floor, among the hot ashes. Leg joint, the bar had burned its way in until stopped by the bone. Dead white scar, which even now causes me some trouble. By this scar I was in later years to be identified by the Japanese. Uproar came rushing from everywhere, still among the hot ashes, but was soon lifted out. But a lot of my body had superficial burns, but the leg burn really was serious. Upstairs to a lama was a medical lama, and applied himself to the task of saving my leg. The iron had been rusty, and when it entered my leg, flakes of rust had remained behind. Pout the pieces until the wound was clean. Then it was tightly packed with a powdered herb compress, was dabbed with a herbal lotion which certainly eased the pain of the fire. My leg was throbbing and throbbing, and I was sure that I would never walk again. When he had finished, the lama called a monk to carry me to a small side room, where I was put to bed on cushions. An old monk came in and sat on the floor beside me and started muttering prayers over me. I thought to myself that it was a fine thing to offer prayers for my safety after the accident had happened. Lead a good life, as I now had personal experience of what it felt like when the fire devils tormented one. What of a picture I had seen, in which a devil was prodding an unfortunate victim in much the same place as I had been burned. I thought that monks were terrible people, not at all what one would expect. But, monks, what does it mean? Stand that word as anyone, male, living in the lamastic service. Not necessarily a religious person. Almost anyone can become a monk. Often a boy is sent to be a monk without having any choice at all in the matter, or a man may decide that he had had enough of sheep herding, and wants to be sure of a roof over his head when the temperature is 40 below zero. Becomes a monk not through religious convictions, but for his own creature comfort. Their domestic staff, as their builders, laborers, and scavengers. In other parts of the world, they would be termed servants or the equivalent. Most of them had had a hard time. Life at 12 to 20,000 feet can be difficult, and often they were hard on us boys just for sheer want of thought or feeling. Term monk was synonymous with man. We named the members of the priesthood quite differently. Akila was a boy pupil, a novice, or acolyte. Nearest to what the average man means by monk is trapper. Most numerous of those in a lamasery, then we come to that most abused term, a lama. The trappers are the non-commissioned soldiers. Then the lama is the commissioned officer. Judging by the way most people in the West talk and write, there are more officers than men. Lamas are masters, gurus, as we term them. Andup was going to be my guru, and I his kila. Lamas there were the abbots. Not all of them were in charge of lamasaries. Many were engaged in the general duties of senior administration, or traveling from lamasery to lamasery. In instances, a particular lama could be of higher status than an abbot. It depended upon what he was doing. Were living incarnations, such as I had been proved, could be made abbots at the age of 14. It depended upon whether they could pass the severe examinations and stern, but they were not cruel, they were at all times just. Further example of monks can be seen in the term police monks. Porter, they were not concerned with the temple ceremonial except that they had to be present to make sure that everything was orderly. The police monks often were cruel and, as stated, so were the domestic staff. One could not condemn a bishop because his undergardener misbehaved, or expect the undergardener to be a saint just because he worked for a bishop. In the lamasery we had a prison. Any means a pleasant place to be in, but the characters of those who were consigned to it were not pleasant either. Solitary experience of it was when I had to treat a prisoner who had been taken ill. It was when I was almost ready to leave the lamasery that I was called to the prison cell. Out in the back courtyard were a number of circular parapets, about 3 feet high. If stones forming them were as wide as they were high. Tops were stone bars, each as thick as a man's thigh. They covered a circular opening about 9 feet across. Grasped the center bar, and dragged it aside. Rope, at the end of which there was a flimsy looking loop. Unhappily, trust myself to that, honorable medical lama, said the man. If you will step here and put your foot in this, we will lower you. Gloomily I complied. We'll want a light, sir, the police monk said, and passed me a flaring torch made of yarn soaked in butter. Hold onto the rope, and hold the torch, and avoid setting myself on fire or burning through the thin little rope which so dubiously supported me. But down I went, 25 or 30 feet, down between walls glistening with water, down to the filthy stone floor. I saw an evil-looking wretch crouched against the wall. Just one look was enough. There was no aura around him, so no life. Said a prayer for the soul wandering between the planes of existence, and close the wild, staring eyes, then called to be pulled up. My work was finished. Now the body breakers would take over. I asked what had been his crime, and was told that he had been a wandering beggar who had come to the lamasery for food and shelter, and then, in the night, killed a monk for his few possessions, been overtaken while escaping, and brought back to the scene of his crime. That is somewhat of a digression from the incident of my first attempt at kitchen work. The effects of the cooling lotions were wearing off, and I felt as if the skin were being scorched off my body. Increased, it seemed as if it was going to explode. To my fevered imagination the hole was filled with a flaming torch. Time dragged. Throughout the lamasery there were sounds, some that I knew, and many that I did not. The pain was sweeping up my body in great fiery gouts. I lay on my face, but the front of my body also was burned, by the hot ashes. Faint rustle, and someone sat beside me. A kind, compassionate voice, the voice of the Lama Minyadon Up, said, "Little friend, it is too much. Sleep." Gentle fingers swept along my spine, again, and again, and I knew no more. A pale sun was shining in my eyes. First returning consciousness, thought that someone was kicking me, that I had overslept. To jump up, to attend service, but fell back in agony. A soothing voice spoke. "Keep still, Lobsang, this is a day of rest for you." I turned my head stiffly, and saw with great astonishment that I was in the Lama's room, and that he was sitting beside me. He saw my look and smiled. "And why the amazement?" "Together when one is sick," my somewhat faint reply was. "But you are a head lama, and I am just a boy." "Lobsang, we have gone far together in other lives, yet, you do not remember."
"I do. We were very close together in our last incarnations.
But now you must rest and regain your strength.
Save your leg for you, so do not worry."
"The wheel of existence." I thought of the injunction in our Buddhist scriptures, "The prosperity of the generous man never fails, while the miser finds no comforter." "Let the powerful man be generous to the suppliant." "Look down the long path of lives, which revolve like the wheels of a cart. They come now to one, now to another. Today is a prince tomorrow, and the prince may come as a beggar." It was obvious to me even then that the lama who was now my guide was indeed a good man, and one whom I would follow to the utmost of my ability. It was clear that he knew a very great deal about me, far more than I knew myself. I was looking forward to studying with him, and I resolved that no one should have a better pupil. There was, as I could plainly feel, a very strong affinity between us, and I marveled at the workings of fate which had placed me in his care. Placed on a table so that I could see out. Very strange to be resting off the floor, some 4 feet in the air. Fancy likened it to a bird roosting in a tree. Away were roofs beneath the window. I could see Lhasa sprawled in the sunlight. Little houses, dwarfed by the distance, and all of delicate pastel shades. The meandering waters of the Kyai River flowed through the level valley, flanked by the greenest of green grass. The mountains were purple, surmounted with white caps of shining snow. The nearer mountain sides were speckled with golden-roofed lamaseries. Left was the Potala with its immense bulk forming a small mountain. Slightly to the right of us was a small wood from which peeped temples and colleges. This was the home of a state oracle of Tibet, an important gentleman whose sole task in life is to connect the material world with the immaterial. Below, in the forecourt, monks of all ranks were passing to and fro. Somber brown robe, these were the worker monks. A small group of boys were wearing white, student monks from some more distant lamasery. Purple robes and had golden stoles upon them, indicating that they were connected with the higher administration. A number were on horses or ponies. He rode colored animals, while the priests used only white. But all this was taking me away from the immediate present. I was more concerned now about getting better and being able to move around again. After 3 days it was thought better for me to get up and move around. Shockingly painful. The whole area was inflamed and there was much discharge caused by the particles of iron rust which had not been removed. Not walk unaided, a crutch was made, and I hopped about on this with some resemblance to a wounded bird. Number of burns and blisters from the hot ashes, but the whole lot together was not as painful as my leg. Sitting was impossible. I had to lie on my right side or on my face. Obviously I could not attend services or the classrooms, so my guide, the Lama Minya Dondup, taught me almost full time. He expressed himself as well satisfied with the amount I had learnt in my few years, and said, "But a lot of this you have unconsciously remembered from your last incarnation." Chapter 6. Life in the Lamasery. 2 weeks went by and my body burns were very much better. Bulsome, but at least it was making progress. If I could resume normal routine as I wanted to be moving about more, that I should. But I was given permission to sit in any way I could, or to lie on my face, cross-legged in what we call the lotus attitude, but my leg disability definitely prevented that. Afternoon of my return there was work in the kitchens. Bob was to have a slate and keep check of the number of bags of barley being roasted. Barley was spread out on a stone floor which was smoking hot. Was the furnace at which I had been burned. The barley was evenly distributed, and the door shut. That lot was roasting. We trooped along a corridor to a room where we cracked barley which had previously been roasted. Rough stone basin, cone-shaped and about 8 feet across at the widest part. The internal surface was grooved and scored to hold grains of barley. A large stone, also cone-shaped, fitted loosely into the basin. It was supported by an age-worn beam which passed through it, and to which were fixed smaller beams like the spokes of a wheel without a rim. Roasted barley was poured into the basin, and monks and boys strained at the spokes to turn the stone, which weighed many tons. So bad. Then we all trooped around singing songs. At reprimand, starting the wretched stone was terrible. Everyone had to lend a hand to get it moving.
Once moving, great care was taken to see that it did not stop. Eyes of roasted barley were poured in as the crushed grains dropped out of the bottom of the basin. The cracked barley was taken away, spread onto hot stones, and roasted again. It was the basis of tsampa. Each of us boys carried a week's supply of tsampa on us, or, more correctly, we carried the cracked and roasted barley on us. We poured a little of it from our leather bags into our bowls. We would add buttered tea, stir with our fingers until the mass was like dough, then we would eat it. The next day we had to work helping to make tea. Out of the kitchens where there was a cauldron holding 150 gallons, been scoured out with sand and now gleamed like new metal. Earlier in the day it had been half filled with water, and this was now boiling and steaming. And crush them up. Brick was about 14 to 16 pounds in weight and had been brought to Lhasa over the mountain passes from China and India. The crushed pieces were tossed into the boiling water. A monk would add a great block of salt, and another would put in an amount of soda. When everything was boiling again, shovelfuls of clarified butter would be added and the whole lot boiled for hours. The mixture had a very good food value and with the tsampa was quite sufficient to sustain life. Times the tea was kept hot, and as one cauldron became used, another was filed and prepared. The worst part of preparing this tea was tending the fires. The yak dung which we used instead of wood as fuel is dried into the form of slabs and there is an almost inexhaustible supply of it. Fires it sends out clouds of evil smelling, acrid smoke. Everything in range of the smoke would gradually become blackened, woodwork would eventually look like ebony, and faces exposed to it for long would become grimed by smoke-filled pores. Help with all this menial work, not because there was a shortage of labor, but so that there should not be too much class distinction. That the only enemy is the man you do not know. Work alongside a man, talk to him, know him, and he ceases to be an enemy. Yeah? Those in authority set aside their powers, and then any subordinate can say exactly what they think. If an abbot has been harsh during the year, he is told about it, and if the criticism is just, no action can be taken against the subordinate. It is a system that works well and is rarely abused. It provides a means of justice against the powerful, and gives the lower ranks a feeling that they have some say. After all, to be studied in the classrooms was on the floor. When the teacher was lecturing to us, or writing on his wall board, he stood in front of us. But when we were working at our lessons, he walked about at the back of us and we had to work hard all the time as we did not know which of us was being watched. Anshul stick and did not hesitate to use it on any part of us within immediate reach. Shoulders, arms, backs, or the more orthodox place. It did not matter at all to the teachers, one place was as good as another. We studied a lot of mathematics, because that was a subject which was essential for astrological work. Our astrology was no mere hit or miss affair, but was worked out according to scientific principles. Of astrology drummed into me because it was necessary to use it in medical work. Better to treat a person according to their astrological type than to prescribe something quite haphazardly in the hope that as it once cured a person, it may again. All charts dealing with astrology, and others showing pictures of various herbs, changed every week and we were expected to be entirely familiar with the appearance of all the plants. We were taken on excursions to gather and prepare these herbs, but we were not allowed to go on these until we had a far better knowledge and could be trusted to pick the right varieties. Gathering expeditions, which were in the fall of the year, were a very popular relaxation from the strict routine of the lamastic life. Sometimes such a visit would last for 3 months, and would take one to the highlands, an area of ice-bound land, 20 to 25,000 feet above the sea, where the vast ice sheets were interrupted by green valleys heated by hot springs. Experience matched perhaps nowhere else in the world. Being 50 yards one could range from a temperature of 40 below zero to 100 or more Fahrenheit above is quite unexplored except by a few of us monks. A religious instruction was quite intensive. Every morning we had to recite the laws and steps of the middle way. These laws were: 1. Have faith in the leaders of the Lamasery and country. 2. Perform religious observances, and study hard. 3. Honor to the parents. 4. Respect the virtuous. Honor elders and those of high birth. 6. Help one's country. 7. Be honest and truthful in all things. 8. pay heed to friends and relatives. 9. The best use of food and wealth. 10. The example of those who are good. 11. Show gratitude and return kindness. 12. A measure in all things. 13. Free from jealousy and envy. 14. Refrain from scandal. Be gentle in speech and in action and harm none. 16. Constantly told that if everyone obeyed those laws, there would be no strife or disharmony. He was noted for its austerity and rigorous training. Number of monks came from other lamasseries and then left in search of softer conditions. Them as failures and upon ourselves as of the elite. Any other lamasseries had no night services. The monks went to bed at dark and stayed there until dawn. To us they seemed soft and defeat, and although we grumbled to ourselves, we would have grumbled still more if our schedule had been altered to bring us to the inefficient level of the others. The year was particularly hard. Then was the time to weed out those who were failures. Could survive on visits to the frozen highlands in search of herbs, and we of Chakpori were the only men to go there. Wisely our leaders decided to eliminate the unsuitable before they could in any way endanger others. During the first year we had almost no relaxation. No amusements and games. Every waking moment. One of the things for which I am still grateful is the way in which we were taught to memorize, but we who were training to be medical monks had to know the names and exact descriptions of a very large number of herbs, as well as knowing how they could be combined and used. About astrology, and be able to recite the whole of our sacred books. A method of memory training had been evolved throughout the centuries. We imagined that we were in a room lined with thousands and thousands of drawers. The drawer was clearly labeled, and the writing on all the labels could be read with ease from where we stood. Every fact we were told had to be classified, and we were instructed to imagine that we opened the appropriate drawer and put the fact inside. Clearly as we did it, visualize the fact and the exact location of the drawer. Practice. It was amazingly easy to, in imagination, enter the room, open the correct drawer, and extract the fact required as well as all related facts. To ram home the need for good memories. Shoot questions at us merely to test our memories. Questions would be quite unrelated to each other so that we could not follow a trend and take an easy path. On obscure pages of the sacred books interspersed with queries about herbs. Illness was most severe. Forgetting was the unforgivable crime and was punished with a severe beating. Give a long time in which to try to remember. Would perhaps say, you, boy, I want to know the fifth line of the 18th page of the 7th volume of the Kanjaya, open the drawer, now, what is it? One could answer within about 10 seconds. It was as well not to answer, because the punishment would be even worse if there was any mistake, no matter how slight. It is a good system, though, and does drain the memory. Carry books of facts. Our books were usually about 3 feet wide by about 18 inches long, loose sheets of paper held unbound between wooden covers. Certainly I found a good memory to be of the utmost value in later years. Months we were not allowed out of the lamasery grounds. We were not permitted to return. Peculiar to Chakpori, because the discipline was so strict it was feared that if we were allowed out we should not return. I admit that I should have run for it if I had had anywhere to run. I used to it. The first year we were not permitted to play any games at all. We were kept hard at work the whole time and this most effectively weeded out those who were weak and unable to stand the strain. Hard months we found that we had almost forgotten how to play. Exercises were designed to toughen us and be of some practical use in later life. I retained my earlier fondness for stilt walking, and now I was able to devote some time to it. Started with stilts which lifted our feet our own height above ground. Longer stilts, usually about 10 feet high. On those we strutted about the courtyards, peering into windows and generally making a nuisance of ourselves. No balancing pole was used. When we desired to stay in one place we rocked from foot to foot as if we were marking time. The risk of falling off if one was reasonably alert. Fought battles on stilts. Of us, usually 10 aside, would line up about 30 yards apart, and then on a given signal we would charge each other, uttering wild whoops calculated to frighten off the sky demons. Said, I was in a class of boys much older and bigger than myself. This gave me an advantage when it came to stilt fights. They lumbered along heavily, and I could nip in among them and pull a stilt here and push one there and so send the riders toppling. On horseback I was not so good, but when I had to stand or fall on my own resources, I could make my way. Another use for stilts, for us boys, was when he crossed streams. I'd wade carefully across and save a long detour to the nearest ford. I remember once I was ambling along on 6-foot stilts in the way and I wanted to cross. The water was deep right from the banks, there was no shallow part at all, and lowered my stilted legs in ease. As I walked out in midstream it rose to nearly my waist. Just then I heard running footsteps. A man hurried along the path and gave the merest glance at the small boy crossing the water. Apparently, seeing that the stream did not reach my waist, he thought, "Ah, spot." There was a sudden splash, and the man disappeared completely. There was a flurry of water, and the man's head came above the surface. His clutching hands reached the bank, and he hauled himself to the land. His language was truly horrible, and the threats of what he was going to do to me almost curdled my blood. I hurried off to the far bank, and when I, too, reached shore, I think that never before had I travelled so fast on stilts. Of stilts was the wind which always seems to be blowing in Tibet. I'd be playing in a courtyard, on stilts, and in the excitement of the game we would forget the wind and stride out beyond the sheltering wall. Gust of wind would billow out our robes and over we would go, a tangle of arms, legs and stilts. There were very few casualties. Studies in judo taught us how to fall without harming ourselves. We would have bruises and scraped knees, but we ignored those trifles. Some who could almost trip over their shadow, some clumsy boys never learned breakfalls and they at times sustained a broken leg or arm. There was one boy who would walk along on his stilts and then turn a somersault between the shafts. He seemed to hold on the end of the stilts, take his feet from the steps, and twist himself round in a complete circle. Feet would go straight over his head and down to find the steps every time. He did it time after time, almost never missing a step or breaking the rhythm of his walk. I could jump on stilts, but the first time I did so I landed heavily, the two steps sheared right off and I made a hasty descent. After that I made sure that the stilt steps were well fastened. My 8th birthday, the Lama Minyadon Up told me that the astrologers had predicted that the day following my birthday would be a good time to open the third eye. This did not upset me at all. I knew that he would be there, and I had complete trust in him. Third eye open, I should be able to see people as they were. It was a mere shell activated by the greater self, the overself that takes over when one is asleep, or leaves this life, the infirm physical body, so that he can learn lessons and progress. Man returns to a different plane of existence, down to rest, and the spirit disengages itself from the physical body and floats off when sleep comes. Is kept in contact with the physical body by a silver cord which is there until the moment of death. The dreams which one has or experiences undergone in the spirit plane of sleep. The body, the shock of awaking distorts the dream memory, unless one has had special training, and so the dream may appear wildly improbable to one in the waking state. Will be mentioned rather more fully later when I state my own experiences in this connection. Surrounds the body, and which anyone can be taught to see under suitable conditions, is merely a reflection of the life force burning within. We believe that this force is electric, the same as lightning. Best scientists can measure and record the electric's brain waves. People who scoff at such things should remember this, and remember, too, the corona of the sun. Here flames protrude millions of miles from the sun's disk. The average person cannot see this corona, but in times of total eclipse it is visible to anyone who cares to look. It does not matter whether people believe it or not, will not extinguish the sun's corona. Still there, oh, is the human aura. Aura, among other things, which I was going to be able to see when the third eye was opened. 7. The opening of the third eye. My birthday came, and during that day I was at liberty, free from lessons, free from services. Early morning, have an amusing day, Lobsang. We are coming to see you at dusk. It was very pleasant lying on my back, lazing, in the sunlight. Below me I could see the Potala with its roofs agleam. Behind me the blue waters of the Nobulinga, or Jewel Park, made me wish that I could take a skin boat and drift along south. I could watch a group of traders crossing the Kai Chu ferry. Too quickly for the day, the evening was born, and I went to the little room where I was to stay. There came the murmur of soft felt boots on the stone floor outside, and into the room came three lamas of high degree, put a herbal compress to my head and bound it tightly in place. The three came again, and one was the lama Minya donned up. Fully the compress was removed, and my forehead wiped clean and dry. A strong-looking lama sat behind me and took my head between his knees, opened a box and removed an instrument made of shining steel.